The award-winning Mercedes-Benz Vito invites you to Get This with Tony Martin and Ben Elton.
Yes, good morning, ladies and gentlemen. Welcome aboard. No talk of turkey slapping today. No mention of a certain celebrity fisherman. No, well, references to obscure Aussie Joe Bugner films or slagging of Nickelback. It's an all Ben Elton hour coming up on Get This.
This show is disgusting and degrading and should be pulled.
That'd be those mentals here at Triple M. Let's get this. Welcome aboard, everybody. It's myself, Tony Martin, that man, Richard Marsland.
Good morning, Tony.
Did you do anything on Rove last night? Was there anything?
Well, I had a hand in writing something that ended with John Howard being blown up by the Taepodong 2 from North Korea.
Oh, so. Well done. Give yourself a round of applause.
Possibly seditious.
And if you've got any more on the tank, here's Ben L. Look, there he is.
Mate, you know, I was on Rove and I thought that was fantastic. I really enjoyed it. It was a very nice piece and very well voiced by the, what's his name, really nice, with the big bloke next to him. Yeah, excellent, yeah. Peter. It was great. Really good bit of work.
And what did they have you doing on Rove? You
went I didn't get the main interview, mate. I can't tell you, I was pipped at the post by a Muppet or indeed a similar thing. I'm afraid Elmo got the full sofa treatment from Rover, and I just joined the panel for a few gaggettes. Rover always does a decent thing, plugged all the gigs, and it's always a play. I've done Rover so many times. You can't always get the centre stage, particularly when there's a large man with his hand up a puppet's bottom.
Can't compete with that.
You can't compete with a bit of fisting.
Last time Mick Molloy was on that show, I said, how did you go? He goes, mate, I was on after Kamal being wheeled out on an office chair.
Well, you know, it was good fun. I'd always have a few beers after. There's a great band on. I'd never heard of them before, but my God, what are they on? They're called The Great or something. This great. Crazy girl jumping up and down. I heard of them. Real sort of power pop. Reminded me of sort of just post-punk kind of wackiness. Wow. It was really good. I thought they were excellent.
I'll write that too.
All right. Did you do all their songs, yeah. Yeah. Well done. You know, Ben, you're here, and when it's somebody...
I am here, and what an observation to make.
In the same room as
exactly
well,
really.
I'd like to point out. But when people from overseas are here, you feel like saying welcome to the country, but don't you sort of live here anyway?
Not at the moment. No, we live in Britain, but I have lived here many times, and we'll live here again. In fact, I lived in Melbourne for 3 years, 90 through to 93.
Oh,
yes. 99. Yeah, well, I was commuting. Sophie, my wife, was living here. We had rented a house in Richmond, and I was here about half the time. I wrote Gridlock overlooking the MCG.
And now there is a gridlock all around the
there
MCG.
There is indeed a gridlock. There was indeed then as well, it doesn't sound. So you can see the kind of effect my polemics have. We're now, Sophie's a West Australian, and we were only over here because they were trying to, the Jam Tarts were trying to get a deal and never happened, right. et cetera. So our Australian life is West Australian. We have a home in Frio and in Margaret River, but we're not there. We're in Sussex. So it's really weird. I'm back in our old drinking stamping ground of Melbourne, and Sophie's with the kids in London, so I guess I got a better deal, particularly hanging out with you guys.
So you don't need people to explain things to you for your act?
I had to have turkey slapping explained to me because it was on everybody's lips.
It certainly was. But it's just a bit of harmless fun.
What a great phrase to enter the lexicon of the contribution that Australian English has made to the language has been fabulous, and yet another great Aussie first, turkey slapping.
Yeah, but come on, I mean, it's pretty tame compared to what goes on in your UK. Hey, Big Brother.
Everyone seems to think this, but it's not true. We don't have a lot. There's the same, you know, salacious prurience, you know, like, oh, surprise, surprise, Channel 10. You get a load of young sort of dickheads, you get them pissed up and put them in a room together for 3 months. They go crazy and one of them gets his dick out. What a surprise. Wasn't that quite what you were hoping would happen? And now they've even got the Prime Minister promoting the bloody show, because if anything is more likely to make people watch the show in their demographic, it's boring old John saying don't. But no, the UK Big Brother's just the same, you know. Sort of, you know, a bunch of dickheads in a house, you know. No, they don't. There's no one's had a root or anything, is it? You know, oh my God, they're fumbling under the blankets. Let's watch that again, you know. Still to come. Oh, is that a little bit of rhythmic movement under the blanket?
Not enough cameras in the house, apparently. They need to get the cameras under the blankets.
They're gonna do that. It won't be long before they'll be having the live pissing, honestly, because when I wrote Dead Famous, they actually were still having separate dorms. You know, there was a girls' dorm and a boys' dorm, and there was never any. You never saw the toilet or anything. Now it's slowly but surely it's getting there, and they're talking, and it's voyeurism. You know, people like watching people. That's all it is.
The toilet will be having its own separate spin-off show.
Exactly. exactly, the lav cam, the blammer cam.
Now, you mentioned your book Dead Famous, and that was a terrific read.
Which I'm not plugging, you're welcome to go and get it, but...
Do you know Alan Davies, the comedian, British comedian?
Yeah, I don't know him, but I've, you know, met
him. He plays Jonathan Creek.
That's right, yeah, kind of curly-haired.
He came in on one of our shows once, and he goes, oh, I had a great idea for a book. He goes, I had a fantastic idea for a book. It was about a murder in the Big Brother house, and I locked myself in my house and wrote it for a week, and then I popped down the shops, and bloody Ben Elton already had it out. How many books
have I've met him, he didn't mention it, but only very briefly at one of those talk over the shoulder of the other blokes at a soirees.
A lovely bloke, lives in a windmill.
He does seem like a lovely bloke. I know a lot of people who know him, and that's good. Well, it was an obvious idea. I remember when I was writing it, thinking, gosh, I honestly remember thinking, I'll bet some hell bloody right this. So I obviously had a bit of a channeling moment with Alan, but because it's a classic Agatha Christie situation. I mean, she invented a brilliant sort of like structure for novel writing, which is the closed house murder. You know, it was her idea, it's brilliant.
Yeah.
You know, it's snowed up, the lines are down, no one can get in, no one can get out. A stranger occasionally turns up, which they also do with Big Brother. It struck me as a classic modern version of that, particularly with all the cameras watching as well. But what's interesting is how tele-literate people have become. Big Brother contestants now know the kind of process. They know they're being edited and watched. I remember when I was writing Dead Famous, I was actually making an original observation to point out this is as far from reality as a scripted sitcom, because you are watching the script of the editor. And if they want to make you imagine that one of the contestants has fallen in love with a chair, all they need to do is have an isolated shot of a chair, isolated shot of a contestant looking moodily into the distance, and bang, they've got a furniture fetishist. And at the time, I was pointing that out as a revelation. But now I think everybody knows it. They know they're making him look that way. They're making her look that way. It's interesting. We're sort of, you know, we're going to go into a fourth dimension, because first you had the idea of reality television, then the penny dropped that this is not real, and now you've got people who know it's not real trying to play it to make it look real.
Yes.
And so we're sort of already 3 degrees of separation from any reality at all, and we are fast going up the proverbial arsehole.
Oh, I just know that somebody's sitting there writing down that furniture idea. That's fantastic. Sofa slapping. That could take off.
You're not telling me you haven't draped the old fella across a bit of beige in your time.
Ben,
drag it over the Velcro.
Let's do it. Let's have a crack at that next on Get This. That'd be Snow Patrol. You're all I have here at Get This on Triple M. All we have today is Ben Elton sitting in.
It's all you've got, and is it enough, and is enough ever enough? I don't know.
Look, I'm looking at you, holding this microphone in this picture. How long is it since you got out on the stand-up game,
Ben?
Well,
actually, it's only a few weeks, because I've just completed a grueling 60-day tour of the UK, all as a preparation for playing here in Australia.
Understood.
Obviously, I see the United Kingdom gigs just as a sort of pedestal upon which to put the statue, which is the Australian audience for me. But before that, prior to embarking on Get a Grip UK, it had been about 9 years, but it didn't feel like it.
No?
I've been busy, and I never really noticed that I wasn't doing stand-up, because I tart myself around a bit, you know, I'm on Parky over there and Rove over here fairly regularly with the books and things like that, so yeah. I always feel, you know, I hadn't really noticed until I sat down to try and write 2.5 hours of new gear.
And how do you start? Where do you begin? I mean, do you have is there a pub nearby where you live where you can sneak out and run 5 in? Or
you've got three small kids, you don't get to sneak out of the pub so much these days, you know what I'm saying? We do our drinking at home, and believe me, after you've got the kids to bed and you're shaking a hand, tries to get a corkscrew in, and you're stabbing your hand because you're missing a bottle with the horror of it. I love them twist-offs. Now you can get good wine in twist-off bottles. It's just fabulous. You've got a whole extra 45 seconds of drinking time with those twist-offs. do I write my act in a pub?
Where do you try out the material?
I don't try it out. I start the tour.
You
bang.
Book a big theatre, you're doing 2.5 hours.
Well, I did do 3 in smaller theatres, which was a bit of luck, actually, because although we didn't invite the press at all and there was no hoo-ha about it, there was some interest because, you know, I hadn't gigged for so long, and I did my first big gig in Reading, at a Reading Hexagon, about 1,500-seater. And they turned up. And luckily, amazingly, because I get some good reviews, but normally, you know, you get bagged, you've been around so long, you know. Amazingly, they liked it, and I was bloody glad I'd done 3 warm-ups to learn the material. But, I mean, I started, and I did 3 200-seaters.
Yeah.
But the first game, 200 punters is a scary audience.
Yeah.
And they'd all paid, you know. But I find you do try out stuff, it doesn't try it out. You've got to do it for real. So I tried it out on the foliage. I walked around the garden for a month. You know, my kids looking out the window thinking Dad's gone crazy because all I can see is me sort of shouting and ranting at the trees and effing and blinding. And their mums said, don't go outside, you'll hear Dad say something foul that we don't want you to hear for at least another 5 years. I sit and write and go out and shout at the trees and then go back into my little study. I've got one in the garden, it's like a shed.
Right.
And, write a bit more and tease my imagination. I spent about 2 months writing it, learnt it, got up stage, did it. Fabulous.
We must remember to try material out on trees for this show, Richard. Write that idea down.
I tell you what, they don't laugh, but then they don't shit in you either, you know. But then the birds in them do, you know, whatever.
When I started out doing stand-up, I was so terrified. I remembered reading an interview with you where you described your early gigs, and you said the key was to talk as quickly and loudly as possible.
These are the days, did I not say? I used to say that Mother Nature's greatest mistake was locating the nervous system in the middle of the digestive system. The arsehole of a stand-up comic ages at twice the speed of his or her body.
Very true.
Maybe in my 40s, but my bum can remember the war. Honestly, I developed my kind of rat-a-tat machine gun, my trademark motor mouth delivery.
Yes.
I'm a bit of a fast, gabby sort of talker anyway, but there's no doubt about it. In those early days in the comedy store, horrible gigs, unpleasant. I used to talk very fast, very loud, very aggressively in order to not let, you know, hecklers and scumbags get a word in edgeways. And the reason is I think they are scumbags. I live in hope of that famous witty heckle. All heckles are the same. Drunk dickhead at the back wakes up, F off, you're not funny. And, you know, people think that kind of the heckling, oh, did you get heckled? Is that great? Look, I don't anymore because people come to see me and that's nice, but I deal with it very aggressively because my view is that the punter has paid their money to hear what I've got to say, which I've worked on and studied. You know, the old heckle put down, you know, what did it say on the poster, Ben Elton or Ben Elton plus some dickhead who can't keep his mouth shut, you know. it doesn't happen much anymore, but as far as I'm concerned, I'm on stage to deliver ideas. You know, I've gone on the road again, not because I've got a load of old gags I want to trot out for another outing, but I've got a new show, new ideas, new thoughts, and the public, if they've paid, they obviously want to hear it. And fortunately, nobody, you know, people understand that, and so there isn't heckling. But on the whole, my view of heckling is that it's almost always destructive. Obviously, the fun of watching someone deal with a heckler, there is some skill in it, but it's a very gladiatorial sort of thumbs up, thumbs down sort of skill. And I used to be the comedy store compere because I was, you know, I was good at the job and I could run a room. And you get some kind of quite sensitive act to go on, trying to establish something. Takes a few minutes, don't give him a second because this is going to be good. You know, you imagine if, you know, Mort Saal or, you know, one of the, you know, so, or, you know, Woody, somebody's ideas. And of course, the second there's a pause, some idiot's ruining it. You know what I mean? So no, if you're out there, hecklers, just have a little look at yourselves. Look in the mirror and just ask yourself, exactly how witty are you? And if you were witty enough to be on stage as a comic, perhaps you'd be doing it, my darling.
I've heard so few good ones, really, over the years. I remember somebody doing a particularly bad gig where they said, look, and they were being heckled and they said, look, I've only got 3 minutes up here, and someone went, go and boil an egg!
No,
all right.
Look, there are a few. Of course there's witty. I mean, if a taxi for me, you know, like in a pause, taxi for Mr. So, you know, that kind of thing. But, you know, look, obviously, if you really have got somebody on stage who shouldn't be on stage, who's clearly got some kind of arrogant kind of wish, death wish, but all I'm saying is give the comic a chance. I mean, in my day, luckily, social politics have changed a lot in stand-up. And in the early days at the comedy store, it was still, believe it, it's funny to think that it was still a time when somebody could shout, get us your tits, give your tits out or whatever, and wouldn't feel, I mean, even the biggest bogan would now know that is like, oh, please. You know what I mean? You've got to do better. But literally, Jenny and Dawn French and Saunders wouldn't play the London Comedy Store because in the early 80s, a woman got on stage, get your tits out. So honestly, I promise you, and it was the same over here, that's changed, so that's a good thing. But witty heckles are a lot rarer than witty put-downs.
I think the key is there's a couple of triad rooms in Melbourne where the whole audience is made up of really comfy couches and armchairs.
Mm.
And I've been along and you've seen terrible people on stage and no one ever gets heckled.
The audience is asleep.
I think it's either sleep or it's just you can't get angry in a nice comfy couch.
It's really weird you should say that. When I go into a theatre, you know, like these days, the council refurbishes theatres, and you suddenly go in, and every seat is like a bloody armchair, and it's all very nice if you're listening to La Traviata or whatever, but it's actually wrong. It was wrong for, we had a lovely, I can't remember what theatre we were in for We Will Rock You, and it's a fantastic theatre, and really well looked after, but unbelievably comfy, spacious, huge seats, not good for jumping on your feet, waving your arms and giving it, we are the champions, you know what I mean? I think there's a happy medium, and I actually don't believe an audience should be too comfortable. It's right. Like with pubs. I don't want to sit in an easy chair in a pub. You know, you go in these modern sort of chill-outy sort of places, and like there's soft furnishings. You know, a beer, you want to be sat up high, you know, elbows on the table, you know, giving it large to whoever you're talking to. Not, you not sort to, of 8 feet away from them in a sort of, like, sinking into the furnishings.
We want it to look like it is on EastEnders.
Well, I believe me, there's a reason pubs develop like that, because it's a nice way to drink and to talk. You know, you don't want to eat your dinner in an armchair. You sit up at a table, and I feel the same about boozing. Certainly for stand-up comedy, if it is really sort of, you know, if people are sat low, sat far back, they can't get on the edge of their seats, I think it does genuinely change the gig, and the same for rock and roll as well.
The seating is excellent.
It doesn't matter what the seating is like, I'm superb.
We've talked more about the seating than material.
We were talking about fancying furniture earlier in a Big Brother house situation. We've definitely got a chair gig going on here, haven't we?
It's the theme of the show. Get a Grip is the tour. Yeah. It's coming to the Sydney Capitol Theatre, July 2021-22. Well, sold out 2021-22. What are you getting? Don't give me that. It's sold out.
No. We've added two extra shows in Sydney, one at the Capitol and then another one at somewhere else. And an extra show's been added here in Melbourne at His Majesty's.
His Majesty's Theatre.
And then we got Adelaide and Geelong.
Well, you're going to Geelong. You're at the Gold Coast. You're at Brisbane, August 1 and 2. Adelaide at the Theberton on the 4th and the 5th of August. And, you know, it's not over yet.
Do you get to Perth? Does this version of the M's get as far as across the Manila border?
It probably does on the internet.
Yeah, they're all, honestly, they can't get enough of it on the internet. They say, screw our local stations. We got to get Triple M from Melbourne on our internet.
We do very well.
In London every day, honestly. I'll wake the kids up. Oh, you got to hear what he's saying now.
We're a midnight show. We're actually midnight in London.
Exactly. So. I get them up.
That's when you're up.
Never mind Enid Blyton.
But we do get.
Let's listen to our tapes of Triple M.
Never mind Enid Blyton. Oh, look. We've got some more to get out of Ben Elton yet. We're not finished with you yet.
We got a lot of furniture to discuss.
That'll be coming up.
Get this.
Let's hope those boys can get their lives back on track and make up for the damage they've done.
For the award-winning Mercedes-Benz Vito on Triple M.
Yes, let's get this. It's on Triple M. It's around the nation. I think we've got some chisels, do we? Mm-hmm. Do we, Mr. Marsland? And more Ben Elton in just a moment. Forever Now, or Flame Trees if you prefer. Depending on what state you're in. Oh, get this, it's Triple M. Tony Martin, Richard Marsland, and Ben Elton is our co-host this morning. Ben, what about...
A lot of hosting. Don't I get to announce the Let's Rock with the Chisels or anything like that?
You can throw the nickel back at any time.
I'd like to. Okay, we'll hold on that for a moment.
Hey, what about you're on tour, Get a Grip. You've got to go and see Ben doing his stand-up, but he does lots of other things as well. And, of course, we remember the Black Adder. But what about that Hugh Laurie? Dr. House?
I know.
How well's he done for himself?
That's extraordinary. I mean, in late middle age, the good fairy suddenly nestled on his shoulder. I was having dinner with him in London only the other day, and I hadn't seen him for a year because he spends 9 months a year in the United States making this massive smash hit. Funny thing is, it's actually not so big in Britain. It's on a minority channel. I mean, everyone knows because Hugh's so famous from other things. Everyone knows he's a big star in the States. And, of course, House is much admired and much reported, and it's a big show. But it's not the colossus that it is here and in America. And, I mean, he's one of them. It's incredible. I don't think there's ever been a... And it, maybe Jeffrey Rush, you know what I mean? Suddenly a sort of bloke who's basically got used to what his career is, absolutely out of the blue, takes a different step, a quantum leap, you know. And of course,
And someone English, I mean, like Sid James didn't go over and do Starsky and Hutch.
Exactly. No,
nothing like that ever happened.
It doesn't happen very often. But Hugh naturally is a great leading man. I mean, the fact that he's a wonderful comic and plays silly buffoons brilliantly in the Blackadder and things disguised the fact, which I recognise. I mean, I feel rather proud of the fact that I was punting him as a leading man, as a romantic lead, you know, trying to get Maybe Baby, my movie, funded, which he played the lead in. And it wasn't easy. There was a huge resistance from people who fund movies to having Hugh as a leading man. He said, look, he's not a romantic lead. He's, you know, he's a comic turn, you know.
They want Hugh Grant. Is that who they were suggesting?
Well, of course, we couldn't have got him. I mean, it wasn't that scale of movie. But yes, it was very much if only you could get Hugh Grant. And in fact, Hugh used to constantly be, you know, up against, you know, for all Richard Curtis's films, they'd see Hugh but give it to Hugh Grant. But anyway, now Hugh's got the laugh because not only is he playing a romantic lead, but a really kind of sexy, tough one. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
And his friends have always known that about Hugh. There's a real lot of Clint Eastwood about Hugh. Well,
One of the great things about him becoming successful is a lot of his older stuff is coming out. So there's a show called A Bit of Fry and Laurie, which was him and Stephen Fry, which we never got. We got the later series of it here.
Yeah.
But we never got the early ones. And that's suddenly recently out on DVD just because of Dr. House.
I would love it if maybe Baby got put around a bit, because I'm still very proud of that film, and a lot of, you know, people who see it love it. But, you know, it was a moderate hit. It did okay, you know, it was released around the world. But, you know, I mean, it'd be great if the Hugh Laurie interest would get people to go and see the movie,
What about, so you've directed a film. What was that? I mean, how did you start there? I mean,
It's fantastic fun. It's a really wonderful thing to get the chance to do, because he's a writer to direct a movie where you get every aspect. Because a director is an absolute autocrat until they screw up so badly that they get sacked, which happens very, very rarely, because that is a genuine crisis if you chuck the captain out midstream. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
So basically, once you've got the job and once you're on, you know, you are really in control, and you have all these wonderful talents, you know, cameras, makeup, actors, etc. And they're all working towards realising what's in your head.
And
they're
how fantastic. Did you go with people just asking you 200 questions a day?
I loved it. You do get asked an awful lot of questions, because every single decision. But, you know, I'm kind of energetic guy, and I always, you know, and I feed on, I you know the Ian Forster quote, how can I tell you what I think until I've heard what I have to say? Well, because people are asking you questions, that's when you make your decisions. That's when you improvise your answer. It's not as if I turn up each morning and it was, you know, 5 a.m. Right, I've got all the answers in my head. But as the day progressed, you know, the answers are bubbling because it's exciting. And I think we did a good job. It was a very coherent movie, you know, and it came in under budget and made its money back. But as a writer, as I say, I would find it very, very frustrating, as I know Richard Curtis did, to be the writer of a movie and have it directed by other people.
Yeah.
Because they are in control. And I'm one of those people who resents this whole a so-and-so movie, because it's outrageous. Because if you haven't written it, I mean, obviously, there's actors, there's makeup, there's cameras. But frankly, the writer is seriously at the centre of that, in my opinion. And yet directors somehow managed to sort of hijack the whole thing. So the writer's just like, you know, the stage door cat, and it's the guy who's helming it, you know. Whereas, in fact, if they've got a good camera operator, as I did in Roger, the Aussie camera he's doing most of the pictures, you know what I mean?
How did you go with screen direction? That's the worst thing, isn't it? Left to right?
Which way are people looking? Crossing the line thing. But you've got the genius of it's almost always a girl, called the continuity girl. I'm sure even if it's a boy, they get called the continuity girl.
Yes.
And they are the geniuses of the movie, because you're constantly turning to her and saying, you know, which way do they walk? Have they said this before? What are they wearing? And they've got, you know, I mean, incredible level of concentration.
But they're a nightmare at lunch, because you put your cup down and they go, no, it was just over there.
Move absolutely.
It to the left. So your pants up.
Don't, exactly. You're lifting it with the other hand. You're lifting it with the other hand. I'm not on film. It doesn't matter.
And there's now websites where, you know, the man's, the drink, the level of the drink goes up.
Oh, yeah.
You know, people just spot mistakes.
This website thing. I was talking about these young kids, this band on Rove last night. They were, you know, cracking up about some funny website where everybody gets to take the piss out of Chuck Norris or something. There's a whole world. Do you know about this?
I don't know.
There's a whole world of weird websites that I have not. I mean, it did make me feel old. I thought, I am genuinely. Because there's some people contributing sort of. There's a thing about ninjas and pirates. Have you heard about this?
I don't know.
Website where people sort of do fantasy jokes about ninjas. There was one funny thing. Ninjas can only be attacked by scary stories. They're only vulnerable to scary stories. They can't, I mean, funny sort of ideas. And I'm looking at these sort of 20-year-olds or whatever, and there's a whole world which I know nothing about.
So there's a site where you can make fun of Chuck Norris. Yeah. We make fun of Chuck Norris at our house. Sergeant Moss, we call him, because his beard appears to be made of moss. Mm. It's just growing on his face like
the
moss.
Joke is how hard is he? You know, I think one of the lines they quoted me was, Chuck Norris doesn't sleep. He waits and watches, you know, and I, you know, like kind of funny, sort of weird, sort of. I don't know what we're talking about that for, but
let's not plug Chuck Norris.
There's a brief window into a world of entertainment which I have yet to be a part of.
Well, look, I think it's time to get the listeners on board. We're going to do that next, and you can
throw a few
curly ones at Ben Elton next on Get This. A Smash Mouth, I'm a Believer here at Get This on Triple M, where Ben Elton's sitting in with us. He's on his Get a Grip tour. It's when does the first show actually kick off, Ben?
Wellington this Saturday.
Wellington?
Yeah. Doing 5 gigs in New Zealand and your old patch, and then coming into, I think it's Sydney we start with. I'm not sure. I mean, I really don't know. I don't look more than a minute or two ahead.
July 20th.
I'm on this kind of schedule.
At the Sydney Capitol. We were just talking about the mysteries of the internet, and obviously you've got children of your own. You're creating your own staff who'll be able to explain everything to you.
Well, yeah, I guess they'll have to clue me up when they finally get up to it. I mean, it is weird. I was on Denton. I mean, it's coming out next week. Enough Rope, and I feel a bit of a fogey because a massive frustration with 98% of the internet, in that this idea that it's some kind of wonderful information repository where you instantly have everything at your fingertips. Basically, most of it's bullshit. I mean, the number of times I do interviews where people said, I looked you up on Wikipedia. Oh, so you are some twat from the pub, or what is, you know what I mean? Because it's just whatever train spotter feels like, you know, no research, no editing, nothing. And yet it's got this kind of weird legitimacy because it's the marvellous internet. And I was really bagging it because another thing I do on stage, I do a massive riff on this whole nonsense of conspiracy theories. There is no politics anymore because nobody believes in anything, basically. Right. Well, actually, people will believe anything and trust nothing. Yes. You know, so suddenly what was minority rubbish, like men didn't land on the moon, because of these millions of websites, suddenly everybody's trading this bullshit paranoia. And if you think everything's crap, then there's no point voting, in which case democracy dies. Anyway, that was my sort of riff with Andrew. But then last night, again, I keep plugging these young kids, but... you know, this band, and we're talking about these internet sites, you know, where they're sort of comedy-like exchange. And I'm thinking, well, obviously, you know, if you're using it properly, of course, it's fantastic. The area I think is genuinely corrosive is, one, exchange of paranoia, but two, people thinking that learning to search is learning to learn, and it isn't. I mean, you've got a lot of people who know how to access, but do they know how to absorb? Because in the long run, there ain't no substitute for effort. And a page of print, whether it's on a screen or on a page, takes a minute or two to read.
And Google.
And if you click again after the first sentence, you've learnt nothing.
And you just, and medical problems, have you done that? Have you got
a bit of a pain
in the elbow, a bit of Google that?
I mean, you know, obviously it's good, you know, it's good for porn and train timetables, you know.
It certainly is.
But the...
Have you been to YouTube? That's what we were talking about, just old clips of things.
Yeah, Harry Enfield was telling me he sort of saw some, you know, him at 21 on the telly. I haven't. I've got broadband, but it doesn't seem to be very quick. And also, I don't know, when it says, you know, click to watch this, I just get a little square that says it's downloading and an icon. But when I try and open it, it doesn't open. So I don't really
how old
know.
Are you children?
Yeah, they're six. They'll tell me in a couple
of
years.
Right, they'll be on there.
It's, you know, it's good for email, but again, I mean, I wonder, it's a great shame because we have passed the age when there will be any archives. I mean, you know, the idea of being able to feel or look at annotated, I remember when I was a kid, remember we did Wilfred Owen's poetry at school, and you could actually look at a facsimile of his page with his notes, etc. I mean, look, I love using my word processor to write. Of course I do. But it is a shame that there will be no letters, you know, somebody's letters, because somebody's emails, Monsieur Foot Now. I mean, it's not quite the same.
And you never used to get letters in your letterbox with endless offers of free Viagra.
Exactly. Well, look, I do a whole riff on this about this. Who is it? Who are these people who think that, you know, everybody, you know, you're trying to do your mail and suddenly somebody's saying, you know, don't you think your dick's a bit small? And I say, when you got your mail, this is on the stage, I'm quoting my own gear, but you know, like, all right, when you got your mail through the post, I mean, snail mail, very slow as the IT community derogatory say, but at least the postman didn't heckle you about the size of your dick every morning. And the other aspect with emails that I find worrying is that now people write letters for everybody. It used to be you wrote a letter, only one person was going to read it, took a big effort, and there was a real direct and personal communication. But now, whenever anybody, including myself, you write something rather good, you think, I'll send that to another. You know what I mean? Like, so suddenly everyone's in the loop. So you write something, it's taken a bit of an effort. Oh, God, I can't just send that to one person. That'll probably be of interest. So, for instance, if Brian and I are communicating about We Will Rock You, there's a huge temptation, which we've suppressed, to sort of copy, you know, the musical director, the choreographer,
just keep you
in on a loop on all the clever observations Brian and I are sharing. You know what I mean? And I think that is a shame, because I think it does change the nature of what you say.
I sent my wife an email the other day, and she was just up in the front room. And I just couldn't be bothered. How many sugars?
Well, that's the famous scene from Bridget Jones, that first scene where her and Hugh Grant are kind of exchanging flirtations from one room in an office to another. And that when that was happening, I thought, what's she talking about? Because this was like 10 years ago, and I was so not up to speed at that point, you know. But anyway, now I'm with it too. I'm not a Luddite. I'm not seeking to turn back the clock. But no. I do think it's time. There's a bit too much eulogising about the endless information possibilities and a bit too little pointing out of the endless bullshit possibilities.
The endless breast possibilities.
Yes, absolutely.
Look, Ben Elton is here. Why should we have all the fun? Give us a call. Ask him a question. He'll talk about any topic, some of his work, other people's work, things that are going on. Train timetables.
And if you don't call, I'll get my publisher to do it from outside, just so I don't look too sad.
Richard Marsland will run out and bug on a voice. Yes, he's done it before.
Yeah. I'll do it for myself. Hello, Ben. I'm an enormous fan. Are you? That's fantastic. I love all your work.
Would you have a list of your gigs?
Give us a call. 1-333. Well, it's 1-333-53. Speak to Ben Elton. That's those Chili Peppers, Danny California here at Get This on Triple M. Ben Elton is sitting in for the whole hour today, very kindly. And now, let's throw some punters at him. Who have we got on the line, Richard?
Ian, are you there?
Yes, I am.
What's your question for Ben?
Ben, listen, I've sort of been a big fan of your work for a fair while, actually. The especially, and quoting, harking way back even to the Young Ones.
Yeah, good stuff.
Which I enjoyed immensely, I must admit. Still do whenever it comes back on. I just wondered, when you actually got to filming that, how, like, were those guys as manic as off tap as they were on camera? I mean, did they all suddenly go back and start sipping tea and having cucumber sandwiches after doing all that stuff?
No, like, we were very young, so the people were fairly sort of wacky. I mean, we're all just out of university, and, you know, we used to drink more probably. Well, actually, we drink. It's still, you know, that when you're young, you can actually have a drink at lunchtime and actually manage to work in the afternoon. Something I definitely can't do anymore. So yeah, we were moderately mad, but there was no drugs around. It wasn't like that. It's hard work to make a sitcom, particularly with a lot of stunts like that. So it's pretty serious. The Young Ones' house. Rick and Aid lived in a house together briefly. And then I briefly was in the same house just after they'd left, but with a similar sort of gang. And once Aid did ride a motorbike up a small Honda 50 up the stairs of that house. But I think that is the only sort of genuine Vivian moment in
never actually put someone's head through a window or hit them with a cricket bat.
A howitzer from a bedroom.
No, like all students, you know, occasionally, you know, if somebody's sort of like got a bit of stock and you think it's rubbish, you do the washing up in it and it's, oh, that was stock, you know, well, we'll eat it anyway. You know, we had plenty of grubby sort of who's going to clean the toilet, you know, sort of moments. But it wasn't that wacky because it's very hard to put. When I first toured in Australia in 86 with Rick, a lot of DJs, you say, oh, it's, you know, a bit disappointed with me because there was Rick Mayall, the big star, and then there's this fart next to him who apparently wrote a lot of it. And they said, but surely the guys make it up. It's so spontaneous. And I go, yeah, of course, because, you know, a stunt like coming through a wall and landing in a bowl of lentils is something you can just say, let's do that in 5 minutes. Get it rigged, you know. No, it takes days of planning.
I watched that series again, Rick. I hadn't seen it for years, and the stuff that really makes me laugh is just Rick Mayall going off at people when he goes off at that old guy in the post office.
Honestly, I don't remember it. I haven't seen him for 20 years, and it's not like out of some, I didn't watch my own work, but why would I? I mean, it's a very, very long time. But I do know from my memories of it that the bits I like was the character work. I was never a big fan of the sort of rats in the skirting boards.
It is the character stuff that holds up.
Surreal stuff. I mean, for me, I always thought that was pretty crappy at the time. What I liked was the interchange between the boys, you know, like going to the laundrette, or my favourite scene, the one I do remember, was revising for his exams, revising to go on University Challenge.
On the train.
The revision thing. You've done loads and loads and loads of work.
That's my single favourite scene in the whole series.
And then Vivian putting his hand out. Oh, but your hand out the window. I remember that was a great episode.
And loads and loads.
You know, don't tell me. Okay, you know. You said don't tell you. Well, tell me now. What tell you now? Then. I do remember it, actually, funnily enough.
There you go. It's all coming back.
Old memories back. Yeah.
Thank you, Ian.
Thanks, Ian.
We got Matthew on the line. Matthew.
Hey, guys. How you doing?
Good, question thanks. For Ben.
Firstly, I'd just like to say that as a 10-year-old, your motivation and motor mouth tapes absolutely warped my mind.
You sound a lot older than 10, mate.
Well, that was when I was a kid.
Oh, I see. Okay. I thought you were saying, speaking as a 10-year-old,
to this day, I still cannot sit in the toilet while there's someone else.
No, you can't.
Is that to do with the album, though, or just generally?
Yeah, well, pretty much.
They were great days of stand-up, and but I'm doing all new gear now, but still
My question for you is a trivia question that's popped around is that apparently you co-wrote a song with Queen back in the day. Is that true?
No, not at all. I mean, I obviously wrote the story and the script for the Queen musical, We Will Rock You. I've never written a song with Queen. We did some revisions of some of the lyrics together, like in Radio Gaga, which opens the show, We Will Rock You. We put some internet references in and things, and we sort of did that together. But that was very minor. I mean, there's no crediting in the program, and nor should there be. I mean, this was a change of the odd word. No, I've never co-written a song with Queen. I wrote a musical. I wrote all the lyrics and the book from musical with Andrew Lloyd Webber, very different genre, but working with Queen, I was the gag man. They did the music, and they didn't need any help from me.
Fair enough.
Well, very nice, Matthew. We're trying to punch a few through here.
Yeah, that it will never go away, probably, on the internet. You know, he wrote a song with Queen, even though he's denied it. I'm sure he did.
He was the lead singer of Queen for 7 years.
Shortly before killing Lady Di and Kennedy, yeah.
That's true. Yeah. Have we got Darren on the line? Darren?
How you going, boys?
Have you got a question for Mr. Elton?
I do, Mr. Elton. I was just wondering what you think, I don't know if you've heard yet, but the John Howard and Peter Costello situation at the moment.
Yeah, didn't Costello's
turkey whacked Howard in a cabinet meeting or something? Wasn't there some
speaking, that's a good way to put it.
Some treasurer's droopage across his face, I believe.
I was just wondering if you got a sidekick or someone behind you who's willing to boot you out in a couple of years.
Waiting for me to... Well, I mean, my children are trying to kill me, but I don't know if that's the same thing. I think it's outrageous, this idea, you know, this bauble of the premiership that he promised me and me promised to... I mean, it's a contempt for the Australian people. As far as I'm concerned, we have the same situation in Britain with Blair and Brown, and people are talking about this when they should be talking about where were the weapons of mass destruction. Hey, Howard, you want to talk about lies? What about the children overboard scandal? Mm-hmm. It seems to me that the trivia, the obsessive personality trivia that the media are prepared to go along with when the real issues are, you know, hey, didn't we fight a war for completely fictitious reasons? Shouldn't you be discussing that? If you're going to resign, resign because of that, not because you promised your mate the job, you prick.
Not because of a letter that's been in someone's wallet for 14
exactly.
years.
Imagine how sweaty that would be if it'd be in his back pocket, kind of, you know.
I think we're finally out of time, Ben.
Oh, well, it's been a great pleasure.
And we didn't get to ask you all the cliched Blackadder questions I had for you.
Well, I love those cliched Blackadder questions.
We'll have to get you back. Meanwhile, Get a Grip is coming to your town. It's coming to Sydney July 20. It's going to be in Perth, if you're listening on the internet, July 23, 24. Melbourne on the 25th. Geelong on the 27th. Gold Coast on the 31st. Brisbane August 1st and 2nd. And Adelaide at the Theberton 4th and the 5th. There'll be a big picture in the newspaper. Just look for the picture of Ben Elton, and there'll be some dates underneath and a phone number. It's really quite simple, I promise you.
Look for my picture and whack that turkey.
Have you got a new... Is there a book that you'd like to mention?
Yeah, First Casualty, my first historical novel, a drama, not that funny actually, some comedy in it. First Casualty, set in World War One, big hit in Britain and here in Australia. All good bookshops, check it out.
No turkeys injured. Thanks for coming in, Ben, and I think our key phrase today was Ben Elton. That's all.
Sorry, I said.
And we'll be back. There's no need to apologise.
Just about to say sorry I said prick, and now I've said it again on air.
It's all thanks to Mercedes Vito.